ready to proceed?
May it please the court, I'm Ken Roseman, I represent the appellant. This is a medical negligence case that involved the birth of Darnaya Sturgis. There were four undisputed facts. Fact number one is Darnaya Sturgis' birth was complicated by a condition called shoulder dystocia. Shoulder dystocia occurs when the baby's shoulder is impacted after the delivery of the baby's head. The second undisputed fact is that Darnaya Sturgis was born with a condition called a brachial plexus injury. A brachial plexus injury is an injury to the nerves in the neck that affect the child's ability to use her arm. The third undisputed fact, and more significantly, is that a brachial plexus injury is caused by the use of excess traction during the course of the delivery. And the fourth undisputed fact was that the use of excess traction during delivery constituted a violation of the standard of care.
But that's not the only potential cause, though.
That's correct. It's not the only potential cause. My trial strategy was to prove that the brachial plexus injury in this case was caused by the use of excess traction. And I intended to do that by eliminating the other possible causes. The other possible causes were, number one, causes that occur in vitro, which is essentially means developmental problems in the womb. Number two, there was a theory that the injury could occur during the baby's descent through the birth canal. And number three was that the injury occurs as a result of excess traction. So my trial strategy was to eliminate one and two. To make that trial strategy effective, I took the deposition of the defendant's expert. The defendant's expert, Dr. Heather Johnson, admitted on cross-examination that the injury did not occur in utero.
Yep. Is that an issue on appeal? I was confused by the brief because in your summary of argument, you're only objecting to limiting the testimony of the plaintiff's expert. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. So what you're going to tell us now about the ruling on the defendant's expert is going to somehow be related to the exclusion of the plaintiff's expert.
Yes.
Okay.
Heather Johnson, Dr. Johnson, eliminated possibility number one, that the cause was in utero. I then examined Dr. Johnson on the possibility of cause number two, that the injury could occur while the baby was descending through the birth canal. And I pressed Dr. Johnson on that point. And Dr. Johnson, after being pressed, finally admitted that that possibility is only a theory, that it has never been proven, that there is no expert, no article has ever been written that could explain how the injury could occur during the baby's descent through the birth canal, and that, again, it's only a mere possibility. Having secure number three, Dr. Johnson also acknowledged in her deposition that the injury can occur as a result of the use of excess traction. So Dr. Johnson basically testified that there were two possibilities, one didn't in utero that didn't apply in this case, and number two was that it occurred during the baby's descent through the birth canal, which was only a theory, and she acknowledged number three, that it occurred as a result of excess traction.
Well, so there's nothing in, according to the testimony and the record, there's nothing in the medical literature that would rule that in, there's a case where they've ruled out in utero and there's a case where they've ruled out excess traction, and therefore it must have been during the course of the birth canal.
There's nothing in the record in which a medical expert who was in this case said that that was a viable theory. In fact, the lower court, and I think this addresses Justice Holland's point, the lower court ruled that the theory that the injury could occur during the baby's descent through the birth canal was only a possibility. And for that reason, Dr. Johnson was precluded from even offering that opinion as a possibility.
So it is a medical possibility.
It is a medical possibility. Well, it's a theory. It is a theory that has not been proven. There is literature.
Let me phrase it this way. The trial judge accepted that it was a medical possibility.
I can't say that. I can't make that acknowledgement, because what the trial judge said in her ruling was that that theory could not be presented to the jury because it was only a mere possibility.
Well, and let's look at the bench ruling that you attached to your brief. It's A24, or it's page 2, when we're talking about your expert. And what the Superior Court judge ruled is, I'm not going to permit him to opine that it either must be an in utero opinion or it must be excess traction. I don't think it's supported by the literature. My question is, was your expert prepared to testify in your expert's opinion in terms of medical probabilities? It's just that, notwithstanding that was your expert's opinion, the Superior Court thought your expert was kind of all alone, and it wasn't supported by the literature.
The trial court, I think, relied upon my acknowledgement that it wasn't unequivocally supported by the literature.
I agree with that. But my question is, was your expert prepared to testify that in your expert's opinion, in terms of probabilities?
Yes. What my expert would have said, and what he said in his deposition, and actually what he said in trial, because it came out in cross-examination, that those were the only two medically recognized causes of a brachial plexus injury, one in utero that didn't apply in this case, and two, the use of excess traction. Had I been able to develop the argument, if that became an issue, my expert would have acknowledged that there is literature out there that talks about the theory that the injury could occur during the baby's descent through the birth canal, but he would have also pointed out, as he did in his deposition that's part of the record, that that theory is completely unsupported by any scientific evidence.
What we're really focusing on then is strictly a Daubert question, whether the Superior Court properly ruled that your offer and your expert's proffer didn't comport with Daubert, therefore it was inadmissible.
That was the ruling. And the basis of that ruling, again, was my acknowledgement that the literature wasn't unequivocal. But the literature...
What does that mean? What did you acknowledge by saying that?
That there was literature there that supported the theory that the defendant's expert had expressed in her deposition, that a baby, that a brachial plexus injury can occur during the baby's descent through the birth canal. There is literature that says that. But even the defendant's expert acknowledged that that literature that does exist is merely theoretical, that no one has ever been able to establish if that injury occurs, how it occurs, and moreover, she admitted that the theory is only a possibility, not a probability, because it simply hasn't been proven.
Well, you're familiar with Daubert, and it's been argued and discussed a lot of times in a lot of cases. But when it went to the United States Supreme Court and they engaged in this discussion about the trial judge's gatekeeping role, eventually they concluded that standard of review would be abuse of discretion. So in this case, how did the Superior Court abuse its discretion in its ruling?
I guess my first answer is the Superior Court actually made a ruling that that theory cannot be presented to the jury. The court made a specific ruling that the theory that an injury occurs during the baby's descent through the birth canal is nothing more than a theory, merely a possibility. Therefore, it can't be presented to the jury. So you have that ruling by the court. But then you have the court's next ruling as to my expert, in which my expert essentially is agreeing with the ruling made by the court that there are only two possible explanations for a brachial plexus injury. One is in utero, and one is it occurs as a result of excess traction. Yet the court says he can't express that theory. And that's the abuse of discretion.
Why did the court say that?
Because the court accepted my acknowledgement that there is some literature out there that prevented me from saying that the literature is unequivocal.
So that relates back to the ruling on what the defense expert was going to say. Is that correct?
I believe so.
So what we have here is a confusion or a blending of two rulings. Your position is if the judge was correct, and the defense expert shouldn't be able to talk about an injury as the baby goes through the birth canal, then you're down to two possibilities. And then what the judge did was inconsistent by saying, well, there's not necessarily only two possibilities, because even though the literature isn't conclusive, there are some things in the literature. And as I understand your argument is, that speculation was eliminated by the ruling on what the defense expert could say. So you really were down to two choices.
I wish I said it that clearly, but that's exactly what my argument was. And that's why I felt there was an abuse of discretion.
Mr. Roseman, let's assume all of that is correct and we accept it, and we're down to it had to be one of those two theories, and both of the experts agreed it wasn't the first of the two, so presumably the only explanation is excess traction during the maneuvers that everyone agreed were done that were appropriate. How then do we deal with Dr. Johnson's testimony that she didn't believe to a reasonable degree of medical possibility that excessive lateral traction had been applied? And in fact, she testified there's no evidence that there was excessive pressure put on the baby. How do we deal with that, even though your expert testified to the contrary? And apparently the jury chose to believe her testimony.
If I could have made my argument, the jury wouldn't even have considered that argument by Dr. Johnson, because I would have been entitled to a directed verdict. I would have established that there was only one possible cause of the injury in this case, and that one possible cause of the injury was the application of excess traction by the defendant. And since it was undisputed that the application of excess traction was the cause of a brachial plexus injury, in this case, I would have been entitled to a directed verdict. I mean, there are many cases where an expert can offer her opinion or his opinion, but if that opinion is contrary to the undisputed facts, the jury is going to be instructed to disregard that opinion. And frankly, that's what I expected to occur in this case. As soon as Dr. Johnson made her admission at the deposition that the possibility that her theory that the injury could occur during the baby's descent through the birth canal was only a mere possibility, I knew that that opinion would not be presented to the jury, and I also believed I would then receive a directed verdict.
And so there's no basis for the jury to believe that something went wrong, but it's not a result of the negligence of the nurse midwife, because the nurse midwife didn't apply excessive traction.
They couldn't have, because the jury would have heard that there are only two possible causes of the injury. One was in utero, and both experts agreed it didn't occur in utero. And the only other way it could occur then would be as a result of the use of excess traction. And once the jury concluded, as they would have required to have, as they would have been required to conclude, that that injury occurred because of the use of excess traction, that had to lead to a conclusion that there was negligence.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes.
Well, just I'd like you to invest 30 seconds in anticipating the argument we're going to hear next, and that is, notwithstanding everything you're speaking about, your expert got to render the opinion that was excluded, and therefore the error was harmless.
The defendant violated the court's order by asking the question on direct examination, on cross-examination, eliciting the testimony. And the jury did hear it. What the jury didn't hear was my opening statement where I'm going to develop that argument. They didn't hear my expert render that opinion and support the opinion. I was prevented from moving for a directed verdict because I would have been entitled to a directed verdict based upon the undisputed evidence. And I wasn't able to argue that issue in final arguments.
Well, did you seek relief from that order in view of the defendant's breach of that order?
I objected to the defendant's breach of that order, and my objection was overruled.
But did you seek any further relief from that?
No.
So your position is the inadmissible evidence because of the ruling came in a vacuum, and that it's not harmless because if it was going to come in as you wanted it to come in, you would have used it affirmatively in your opening, in your direct, and in your closing argument.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Gilbert Shelsby on behalf of the appellee, Mackie Banks. The issue before the Court is whether the ruling by Judge Johnson was appropriate in the motion in limine and the Daubert analysis in which she conducted. And I submit to the Court that her ruling was appropriate for the following reasons. The first thing that she does as the gatekeeper is to determine whether an opinion that is being expressed is one that passes a proper analysis, that it's not simply based on a theory or junk science that then should be presented to the jury. And as the gatekeeper, she did that analysis in this case. What in essence Mr. Roseman attempted to do was to call an expert who was an obstetrician who had a theory, and it was his own theory. And the theory was that the only way in which this injury could occur, if it didn't occur in utero, was as a result of excess traction. That's the only theory, the only way that this could occur. So as part of that analysis, and if we sort of step back, what in essence that argument is, it's similar to a res ipsa argument. It says that if you have an injury, you're born with a brachial plexus injury, and it didn't occur as a result of the development, that the only way that can occur is as the result of medical negligence. That is nothing nothing more or nothing less than a res ipsa argument. And I submit to you that that's not an appropriate application of the law of the state of Delaware. Secondly, when we appeared at the motions hearing, the question was raised. Your doctor has this theory that it can only occur as a result of medical negligence, and that's in essence what he's arguing. Show us something. Show us something that supports this theory other than the fact that it is your expert's opinion. And Mr. Roseman was talking about the literature being, it was not unequivocal. And we're sort of mincing words because...
Well, as I understand what Mr. Roseman says, there were three choices: in utero, passing through the birth canal, or excess traction. And that everyone agreed this injury didn't occur in utero, and that passing through the birth canal is taken out of this case because there's no support in the literature, so you're only left with the third choice.
No, I disagree, and for the following reasons.
You disagree with my characterization of his argument, or no, you disagree with that as a proposition?
I disagree with it as a proposition. I also disagree that was eliminated and for a couple of reasons in this case.
That first, being That being what?
That the that it was eliminated as a possibility.
What,
that this,
what is it?
The injury, the brachial plexus injury being caused by going through the birth canal.
And okay, well, you see, I'm not asserting anything.
Right.
I'm simply trying to understand the case. And my understanding is, from Mr. Roseman, that there were three choices. In utero, passing through the birth canal, or excess traction. And he is arguing to us, passing through the birth canal was taken out of the case because it was not supported by the literature. Therefore, we're down to two choices. You're telling us, I think, you agree it wasn't in utero, but excess traction isn't the only choice.
That's
my
right.
question for you is, where in the record is there another choice?
Well, there is in the record a number of other, and I don't think it's just simply that it can occur going through in utero, but the additional thing that is important is that this injury can occur even if you perform all the appropriate maneuvers. So I don't think it's just a matter of simply saying it can occur in utero. Their argument was, look, the only way this can occur is as a result of medical negligence. That's what we sought to exclude because that's not a proper opinion. And when Mr. Roseman was asked to give us one article, one citation to scientific data that says the only way that this can occur is a result, if it doesn't occur in utero, as a result of development, that it only occurs as a result of excess traction. And he acknowledged to Judge Johnson, there is no literature. It's not that it was equivocal. The reason why she said, I'm not going to let you say this to the jury, is there is no literature that says that.
So your argument is that you could do everything within the applicable standard of care, and notwithstanding the fact that everything was done within the applicable standard of care, nevertheless, there could be a brachial plexus injury.
That's correct.
Well, I'm now confused. I thought your argument was that the plaintiff's theory is based on race ipsa, and it doesn't apply here, and that the real problem with the plaintiff's expert's opinion that it could only have occurred as a result of excess traction was that there was no evidence of excess traction. There was evidence that each of the maneuvers that should have been performed were performed. Then there's a blank because no one's capable of saying here is how, why, and when excess traction was applied. All you have is the plaintiff's expert saying, I've got no other explanation for this at this point other than despite the fact they did all the maneuvers that were appropriate, something went wrong, and that can only be explained by them exerting excess force. But there's no evidence of that. In fact, there's evidence from Dr. Johnson, in her view, that there is no evidence of excess pressure on the baby. That's not your argument?
No, I'm arguing both. I mean, what I argued in front of the jury was that there's no evidence of excess traction because that never occurred in this case. But so we're clear, what he's saying is
there's an opinion that says the injury could not have occurred but for excess traction.
Well, that was his expert's opinion.
Right.
And but Dr. Johnson testified that there were three possibilities. And in terms of the possibilities, what the court said in the ruling was, I'm not going to let you say that it was going through the birth canal as because you couldn't say that with reasonable medical probability. And that was her ruling with regard to that issue. But what's important, and I think a distinction is that the judge wasn't saying, well, we're eliminating that as a possibility in this case. That's why I think res ipsa would never apply because there is another possibility, going through the birth canal, and that this injury can occur even if you do everything you're supposed to do is recognized in the medical literature. In fact, in the transcripts, in the cross-examination of Dr. Malik,
Did the jury ever hear that?
Yes, they did. I can give the court some examples. In my appendix, B21 was my cross-examination of Dr. Malik. And I said to Dr. Malik, let's talk about recognized authorities in publications. Let's talk about the literature because they didn't have any literature to support this theory that it only occurs as a result of negligence. Let's talk about the literature. He recognized that the ACOG standards, which is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they have a technical bulletin on shoulder dystocia where they've done research on this. They have the compendium, which is another authority that he recognized. And again, they're all in my exhibits, B21 21 through B24. The following things that he acknowledged that the medical literature says on this subject. It says, injuries are a common outcome associated with shoulder dystocia. And here's the important part. Despite the use of appropriate standard obstetrical measures. I said, isn't that what your organization, you're a member of ACOG, you said this is an authoritative text. They didn't bring any literature in here to say it can only occur as a result of traction. Let's talk about the authority, which is the ACOG standard. And what does it say? It says, if you do everything right, if you do every maneuver, you still have babies who are born with brachial plexus injuries. And he says, yes, that's what it says. I don't agree with it. I think it can only occur as a result of excess traction. That was his theory. That's fine. But that is hard literature, and literature that he acknowledged. It went before the jury. There was additional cross-examination on Exhibit B24, page 95 and 96. Brachial plexus injuries occur when they do C-sections on babies. Now, they do C-sections to get babies out so they don't get stuck in the birth canal and have a brachial plexus injury, but they still happen. And he acknowledged, yeah, there's literature, there's studies that show that. I cross-examined him on additional ones on...
So that's an example of in utero, is that right?
That's an example of in utero. Okay. But there was also, and there's another one, it was important, I thought, it's exhibit in my appendix, B34, it's page 136 and 137. And again, these were studies that were compiled, this information, the ACOG standards were compiled by the National Institutes of Health, by experts and studies. It was an accumulation of studies. But one of the things that they did was that they did some testing to determine the amount of force that was being applied with the obstetrician delivering babies who got stuck in these shoulder dystocias. And what they found was, and they had some mechanism in order to be able to test the amount of pressure being utilized, that the same amount of pressure that was utilized, that they delivered babies with the same force being applied, and some of those babies had brachial plexus injuries and some did not. And there was pages and pages of cross-examination of his expert that in essence says the authorities say that you can do everything right. You can do all that you're supposed to do. And these children can still be born with a brachial plexus injury. But that wasn't the theory that he was proposing to submit to the court.
Well,
so
let's go back to the ruling. I understand what you just told us about the literature, and the plaintiff's expert disagreed with the literature. But is that a basis for excluding the plaintiff's expert's opinion?
Well, when you step back and you say, you're doing a Daubert analysis, and he comes before the court and says, I want an expert to testify it can only occur as a result of medical negligence, because that's what he was asking. And there is no literature. Mr. Roseman's not standing in front of you saying, well, here's the literature that says it only can occur as a result of medical negligence. And the court says, well, how am I going to let a jury be told a theory of a doctor in Pennsylvania who's going to come in front of a jury in Delaware that the only way this can occur is a result of medical negligence? No, I'm the gatekeeper. I'm not going to permit that to occur. Not when the defendants can, and it's part of the record in this case, submit evidence from ACOG and other organizations that say, you do everything right, you still have this outcome. There is plenty of evidence that says that these things happen no matter what you do, no matter what precautions, no matter what occurs.
So then, as I understand your position, what the Superior Court judge did was say to the plaintiff's expert, you can't testify about that as a general proposition, res ipsa. What you need to do is look at this record and then give an opinion on what was done in this case specifically that was negligent.
That is correct. And so there's no question about it in terms of what he was permitted to do. He had a doctor who came in and said, they should have called another doctor, that my client didn't do the McRoberts maneuver, which is one of the maneuvers that should have been done, that she didn't do the wood screw maneuver, which is moving the baby in a certain position. She identified multiple breaches in the standard of care. He said, if those things had been done at one point in time, he said, if those had been done, we wouldn't have had the injury in this case.
So, and there was some testimony about there should have been two assistants rather than one.
That's correct. So, you know, there were multiple breaches. And what the court's saying is bring an expert in, look at this record, and say, here's what she did wrong. If she had done those things right, we wouldn't be here today. But don't come into this courtroom with a theory that says, hey, you got a bad outcome, that has to be medical negligence. That's what he was asking to do. That's why the court, I think, appropriately made the ruling that they did.
So looking at the five factors under Potter versus Blackburn, which of those factors did the plaintiff's expert not satisfy here?
You mean in terms of the Daubert analysis?
Right.
Well, that it's an opinion that is supported by literature. It's not an opinion supported by literature. There's no literature to support that. There is no...
I don't see the word literature in the...
Well, scientific... scientific studies, which would support the analysis that it is recognized with recognized scientific basis for that, none of that falls within the category of the kind of analysis. And in essence, what Daubert is, as I understand,
I'm looking at page 13 of your brief,
okay,
where you quoted Potter, and there are the five-step test for determining admissibility. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It clearly does not. It's not based on information reasonably relied upon by experts in the particular field, because we're talking about an opinion that was given, which was based on no study, no literature, no practical experience, no understanding whatsoever in the medical science which would support that. No literature. We have access to the I know my time is just about to run out, but the amount of time the amount of literature that's available to come in and say we've done some studies that support this. This is the only way that this can occur, and for that not to exist, to have never existed in any aspect of this case. In fact, the evidence of the literature to be completely contrary to that, I would suggest to the court, is overwhelming evidence that this is the type of opinion which is simply, it's an opinion of a doctor, but it is not based on any reliable scientific data.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. The plaintiff's argument is based on two fundamental fallacies, which are both legal and medical in nature. The first fallacy is that the defendant in a case of this sort has the burden to prove the cause of an injury. And that's contrary to Delaware law. It's contrary to 18 Delaware Code, Section 6853. The second fallacy, which is medical in nature, is that you can always identify the cause of an injury such as this. And as the jury heard, that is not the case. What Mr. Roseman attempted to do at trial and is attempting to do in this court is saying, well, if the defendants can't prove it happened in utero or in the birth canal, then it's the result of excess traction, which is negligence. And there's an additional fallacy associated with that, which it assumes that any time a person applies traction to get a baby out in an emergency, that it's negligent. And that's simply not the case. And the jury heard a wealth of reference to the medical literature, which is contrary to that position. Mr. Roseman's witness never identified anything that would allow the opinion that a brachial plexus injury is always the result of negligence fits any of the second, third, fourth, or fifth prongs which Justice Ridgely just asked about. And if such an opinion has no basis, isn't accepted by any other practitioner, it certainly is unfair, certainly is misleading to the jury. Just as importantly, Mr. Roseman hasn't told the court what else his witness would or could have said that would have helped his case. What Judge Johnston didn't understand was that when Dr. Malik testified that the defendant was guilty of using negligent traction in this case. He had no basis for that opinion other than the excluded premise that this injury must always be equated with negligence. So Mr. Roseman accuses the defense of breaching the ruling with respect to Dr. Malik. It was not a breach. We contend that the breach was in allowing the opinion in direct. But that opinion came in. Mr. Roseman has not explained to the court how or why any further opinions would have been offered. He had, once he got that opinion in, he was free to ask the witness to give whatever explanation he wanted in support of that. Well, he didn't do that, and the reason is the only basis the witness had for that opinion was the excluded premise that this injury always equates with negligence. So this court is left with an opinion that to this day has never been shown to have any scientific support and is left with a record where, despite the court's ruling, the opinion was offered, and is left with a record where you don't know what else he could or would have said that would have changed the outcome of this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What the trial court excluded was my expert's right to say this injury occurred either because there's in utero causes or it occurred as a result of excess traction. Those two possibilities are scientifically recognized. The defendant's own expert recognized that in utero and excess traction are causes of brachial plexus injury. What my expert was prepared to say is, if there is another cause, show me what that other cause is, and I'll acknowledge it. And what the trial court said is, we heard a theory of another cause expressed by the defendant's expert, but that theory isn't admissible because it's not scientifically supported, that it's only being investigated, it's only being expressed to a possibility, it's only a theory. So what my expert said was entirely consistent with what the defendant said, and what I wasn't able to do is prove a negative, because there is no other known theory that would establish the cause of a brachial plexus injury other than what my expert wanted to say, that it occurs either in utero or it occurs as a result of excess traction.
Well, what about the ACOG standards?
ACOG, and there is literature that says what is contained in ACOG, but that's the literature that the defendant's own expert denounced as being investigative, experimental, and only expressed to a possibility, because ACOG does support the theory that the injury occurs during the baby's descent through the birth canal. But there is no basis for that literature because there is no one who has ever shown how that injury occurs. I mean, what that literature is based upon, and I know I don't have much time, is basically they go back and they look at records over a period of 10 or 20 years. And there are records that show the existence of a brachial plexus injury without shoulder dystocia being present, without the doctor saying I used excess traction. Well, when a brachial plexus injury occurs, and if the doctor wanted to avoid liability, he simply doesn't put in the record I used excess traction, or he doesn't put in the record that there is a shoulder dystocia. And that allows these researchers to go back and say, well, if this injury occurred and there was no shoulder dystocia and no evidence of excess traction, then it must have occurred during the baby's descent through the birth canal. And that's the literature. That's the theory. And the problem is, if the defendant's expert in this case said, I acknowledge that that's a valid theory, then probably the the trial court would have been correct in allowing that theory to be presented to the jury. But what was unusual about this case is that the defendant's own expert admitted on, after being pressed, that that theory expressed in ACOG is nonsense, that it's investigative, it's a possibility, it's what she said, there's cylinders, there's spheres. I mean, she was double-talking because she realized that there was no scientific support for that literature.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.